knows off the top of their head the answer to this question.
Suppose I have a space with some coordinates x mu and a metric g mu nu.
And let's say it's a Euclidean metric, meaning that all of the eigenvalues are positive, unlike the GR case where the time-like eigenvalue is negative. And imagine that I have a parameterized curve in space. And suppose that I ask, what is the distance between some point x naught on the curve and some point, let's say that's x mu of t naught, and a point on the curve evaluated some small time later, t naught plus dt. How would I write a formula for the distance between these points in terms of the metric and derivatives of the curve? Yeah, okay. Maybe this question was too easy. This formula doesn't really need a derivation since it's more or less the definition of the metric g mu nu. You might notice, however, that this expression is covariant. Its value is the same in all coordinate systems. And the original question that I asked was also phrased in a way where it didn't make reference to a particular coordinate system. And if we go to normal coordinates, where if we simplify the situation by going to normal coordinates where the metric is a delta function, it specializes to the answer that you would expect based on your Euclidean intuition. So one way of thinking about this is that this expression is just the covariant generalization of this formula in normal coordinates. Now let's say that I ask a slightly different question. I have now a function of the coordinates, and I want to consider the level surfaces of the function. So here's a level surface defined by the equation f of x equals f naught, and here's an adjacent level surface defined by the equation f of x equals f naught plus df. If I'm at some point x naught on a level surface, suppose that I ask, what is the distance to the adjacent level surface among all steps that I can take that take me from x naught to some point on the second level surface? There will be one such step with minimum length. So what would be that distance? One way to think about this is just to think about what would happen in normal coordinates, and then find write down the answer, and then find its covariant generalization. In normal coordinates, then what I would do is just take the gradient of the function to the minus 1 power times the step delta f. Make a delta f instead of df. If you want to find the covariant generalization of this, then there's only one choice. You take the gradient of f, which are these partial derivatives, and then you contract with g upper mu nu. That would be the gradient squared. Since I have the minus 1 here, I need the minus 1 half power times delta f. Note that the inverse metric appears when I talk about the distance between level surfaces, and the non-inverse metric appears when I talk about distances along a curve. Now, the Fisher matrix can be thought of, I'm going to rearrange the blackboard a little bit and say that this is the covariant generalization of x dot delta t. This is the Fisher matrix can be thought of abstractly as a function. I have some model space, some parameters that I want to constrain from some data. And at every point, there is a Fisher matrix which transforms the same way that the metric does in general relativity under coordinate transformations. You can think of the Fisher matrix as a defining a metric on parameter space, where the distance between two points corresponds to their observational distinguishability. If the distance between two models is one in the Fisher matrix distance, that means that the models are distinguishable at one sigma. Suppose that I have a parameter that I want to constrain. So you might imagine that the thetas are the six parameters of the standard cosmological model. And f maybe could be some parameter that is derived from them. It could be one of the basis parameters itself. Or it could be some derived parameter like the total age of the universe, which would be a complicated integral over the six parameters. Let me see if I can find like a covariant formula for the statistical error on the parameter f. Well, in a particular case where suppose I rotate to a basis where the Fisher matrix is diagonal. So that means each parameter is independently constrained, and its one sigma error is one. And let's furthermore suppose that I choose the coordinate system so that my parameter f is just the first coordinate in the first coordinate in the parameterization. Then we said in class, by statistical error here, I mean the fully marginalized statistical error. That is to say, if you integrate all parameters, let them all float. Well, we said that in this example, where the metric is delta AB, and the gradient of the function just points in the one direction, is a unit vector pointing in the one direction, that the statistical error is F11 to the minus the inverse Fisher matrix, 1-1 component to the 1/2 power. That was a rule that we wrote down last time. And if you think about what the covariant generalization of that might be, there's only one choice. You take the gradient of the function and you dot it into the inverse Fisher matrix. And this gets raised to the 1/2 power. So this looks a lot like the formula in relativity for the distance between level surfaces. And that makes sense because the parameter f is defining some level surfaces. And the Fisher matrix distance between those surfaces corresponds to their observational distinguishability. This argument is actually a proof that this is the correct formula, since I know what the answer was in normal coordinates. I know, because of the transformation properties of the Fisher matrix, that this expression is independent of the coordinate system. And so if I just redefine coordinates so that I'm in this case, then I get the right answer on the right-hand side. So formulas like this are all over the statistics books, and they're a lot easier to think about if you think about it using this GR intuition. At least I'd like to think about Bayesian statistics using, by sort of mapping it onto GR intuition. It's actually easiest. What the statistics textbooks will say is, if you want to constrain some parameter which is not one of your basis parameters, then what you can do is rotate the Fisher matrix into a basis where it is a basis parameter. But what's actually easier is just to write down a covariant formula that applies in all coordinate systems, whether the parameter that you want to constrain is a basis parameter or not. To the physicist, anyway, this is sort of an easier way of thinking about it. Here's another fun example of a covariant formula involving the Fisher matrix. Suppose that you want to include a Gaussian in the same situation where I have some parameter f, which is not necessarily one of the basis parameters theta I. Suppose that I want to include a Gaussian prior on the parameter f. Now, what I mean by a Gaussian prior is the following. We said last time that if you have independent experiments, then the Fisher matrix for the combined experiments is the sum of the Fisher matrices from the individual experiments. If you want to introduce a prior and say that a particular parameter, I'm going to, rather than letting it be unconstrained before I make the measurement, I want to include a prior that it's equal to its fiducial value with some error bar. That often happens because you have a nuisance parameter in the problem that you want to marginalize or let it float. But there's some reasonable range of values over which it can float, and you want to include that in the forecast. So in this case where, this formula for adding Fisher matrices, I was thinking about the case of doing n experiments. You would include a prior the same way. You can say, whether it's an experiment or a prior, there's just some additive contribution to the Fisher matrix that you put in. So in the case, in this case where the Fisher matrix is the identity matrix, and the function f that you want to put a prior on is one of the basis coordinates, then it's not too hard to see. I forgot to say that when I write the expression for a Gaussian prior, there's always a parameter which is the error that you want to introduce. So you might say, I have some parameter like the age of the universe, and I want to say that it's equal to its some fiducial value plus or minus a billion years. So it's not too hard to see that in these normal coordinates, the way you introduce a prior is you add the Fisher matrix, which is sigma to the minus 2 in the 1, 1 entry, and 0 everywhere else. Remember, the Fisher matrix is the inverse covariance matrix, so its matrix elements are like statistical errors to the minus 2. That would correspond to a measurement where you had a constraint on the first parameter with error bar sigma f, and no constraint anywhere else. So if this is the matrix that I want to get in these normal coordinates, then the covariant generalization is just this. And again, this is actually a proof. It's not just a heuristic way of writing down the right answer. Because if I, this right-hand side is independent of the coordinates. And I know that a basis exists where the formula is correct if I go to normal coordinates. And since both sides transform the same way, if the formula is true in one coordinate system, it has to be true in all coordinate systems. Here's one more fun example. I really like this geometric picture. In the LIGO experiment, for example, they build these template banks. And the way it works is you have some parameter space. You see an event, and then there's some parameter space with parameters like the black hole masses and their spins and so on. Many parameters. Some abstract parameter space. And in order to detect events, each point in the parameter space gives you a waveform. And in order to detect events, you want a library of template waveforms that cover the parameter space. And you want to choose the sampling appropriately. If you sample too coarsely, then you might miss events. And if you sample too finely, then you're wasting computational time because you have redundant templates. So the criterion for choosing the templates is that you know, each of these, this is a Fisher matrix type situation where there's a model parameter space and then there's some data, which is the time series that you observe in the LIGO instrument. And so the way that this tiling is chosen is by the criterion that you want to choose adjacent templates so that they're marginally statistically distinguishable. That is to say, their Fisher matrix distance should be of order one. And this is really what is done. In this parameter space, the metric is computed, the Fisher matrix. And then there's some tiling algorithm that's applied that tries to cover the space by a collection of points whose distances are of order one or some numerical threshold is chosen. If you ask, for example, well, how many points do you need to cover the space? That would be a relevant number if you wanted to figure out how many computers to buy. Then the answer is just the Fisher matrix volume. You integrate square root of f. Just like in general relativity, the integral of g to the 4x times square root g is the covariant volume. A hidden point that I wanted to make with this discussion, these formulas are really useful and much less mysterious if you think about it in this covariant way. But another point that I wanted to make is that statistics is interesting. You might think it might be kind of a dry and boring subject, at least that's maybe what I thought when I first cracked open a statistics book. It's actually kind of mathematically interesting and fun to think about. One of my favorite things about cosmology has actually been that it mixes a lot of different things, and in particular has given me the chance to learn a lot about statistics. For example, suppose that you... So we've talked about forecasting in some depth and introduced some machinery, namely the Fisher matrix. There's also a bunch of machinery in statistics that centers around analysis, where the situation is that you've computed some actual posterior, and you want to explore it as a function of theta to assign confidence regions. Imagine that I told you, I think a good algorithm for exploring this posterior would be to rename the variables of the parameter space to Q, and then introduce some auxiliary momentum-like coordinates P, and then make up a Hamiltonian to the function of Q and P, which has something to do with the likelihood function that you want to explore, and integrate Hamilton's equations of motion for a particle moving around in that phase space. You might think that this is sort of a far-fetched idea for exploring likelihoods that arise in a practical context, but this is actually a very mainstream algorithm that's used in statistics, the so-called Hamiltonian sampling algorithm. A lot of the machinery in statistics derives from statistical mechanics or other parts of physics. That's interesting. Okay, so that's actually all I have to say about statistics. Okay. I'm going to give you a tutorial today that will let you play around with some of these ideas. So I want to stop talking about statistics and switch topics. So far I've been spending a lot of time talking about the mathematics of random fields and statistics. And the situation that I'm imagining is that you have some cosmological parameters and they determine some power spectra. And you then measure those power spectra and convert your measurements to constraints on cosmological parameters. And the way that might work is you have inflation that generates the power spectra of the initial conditions of the... And so the cosmological parameters delta zeta squared and ns would go in here. And then you have the CMB physics. I'm drawing this box bigger because this is really messy and more complicated than the other parts, where some more parameters go in, say omega baryon h squared, omega matter h squared. And then you have the free streaming of the let's call it late time evolution. The free streaming and other late time effects like reionization. So the cosmological parameters, omega lambda, the cosmological constant matters here as well as the optical depth tau. And out come the CLs. We know what to do if everything here is treated as a black box. We have this nice Fisher matrix formalism that will let us infer from the CLs all of these parameters. But so far, we haven't really looked inside the black boxes and talked about the physics. So I'm going to start talking about the physics. And the first thing I want to talk about is inflation, which you guys talked about last time. But so there'll be a little bit of redundancy with what you did before, but not so much, I think, because every cosmologist sort of has their own pet way of thinking about how inflation works, and I think it's useful to see multiple perspectives. And I also just want to go into like a lot more detail of the calculation of how these power spectra get set. So I'm going to spend the next few lectures, I don't think it'll take the rest of the class, but I'll spend the next few lectures talking about the physics of inflation. Just to as a motivation, I'll say a few words about the horizon problem. So the horizon problem is sometimes stated this way. If you observe the CMB, so I'm looking back to the surface of last scattering, then the causal horizon at the time when the CMB fluctuations were generated is very small compared to this radius. So that if I observe points on the last scattering surface that are separated by more than a degree, they were never in causal contact, at least if you just integrate over the radiation, the matter and radiation dominated part of the expansion history back to the hot Big Bang. So I want to distinguish between what I'll call the weak horizon problem. Which is the statement that the CMB is nearly isothermal. Even though the causal horizon is small. So is let's say one degree. So how did the whole surface is, if we ignore fluctuations on the order of 10 to the minus 5, the whole surface is 2.726 Kelvin, suggesting that the universe was once in thermal equilibrium. How did these two points know to equilibrate to the same temperature? With modern data, I think you can say something stronger. Which is the statements that there are long-range correlations in the fluctuations. Long-range correlations. In other words, if I want to make a random simulation of the hot and cold spots in this part of the sky, then the statistical properties of those hot and cold spots will depend on the realization of the hot and cold spots over here. They depend on what a different part of the light scattering surface is doing. So that suggests that whatever physics was generating those initial perturbations was operating before the hot Big Bang, or in some other phase of the universe where different points were in causal contact. Now, the horizon problem is more or less the same thing as the statement that the universe has a finite conformal age. What a finite conformal age would mean is that in proper time, that the light cone expands as I go back, but there's some integral that may converge or diverge. And for a radiation-dominated expansion, it turns out to converge. So if you integrate all the way back to scale factor zero, you only cover a finite co-moving patch of the universe. Or in conformal time, which is a little easier to think about, that the universe also has a Big Bang in finite conformal time. The Big Bang, the fact that the physical age of the universe is finite, you know, means that it only takes a finite proper time to get to A equal, the singularity at A equals zero. And that's also true in conformal time. We reach the singularity in finite conformal time. So the horizon problem, the CMB is generated very close to the Big Bang. So in conformal time, if the CMB is generated here, the past light cone at that time will cover only a very small patch of the universe compared to the total observable co-moving volume. Now, when I first learned about the horizon problem, I guess I was thinking about the weak horizon problem. And it didn't actually seem like a very interesting problem to me, in that we already knew that the Big Bang occurs at a finite value of the proper time. And that's a big problem. I would say it's as much of a conceptual problem. This is just my opinion, but it seems to me that it's as much of a conceptual problem as saying that the universe ends in a finite value of the proper time. If it ended in a finite value of the proper time, then it would be like falling into a black hole and reaching the singularity or something, where we lose the ability to make physical predictions at a finite value of the clock. And when that happens, we interpret it as a sign that we just don't know the laws of physics. Like, we just don't know what happens at the singularity of a black hole. It's not the time ends, it's that our ability to predict has ended. And likewise, I would tend to interpret the fact that a radiation and matter-dominated FRW has a finite proper age, not as the statement that the universe started at a finite time, but we just, as we integrate back, we get a denser and denser plasma, and at a certain point, we just run out of the ability to make predictions. We just don't know what happened before. So we already knew that things were incomplete. Why would it then be surprising to add the puzzle that the universe also has a finite conformal time and therefore a weird causal structure? I mean, there's obviously something missing. So what I think is actually, very interesting about this horizon problem is this statement, the strong horizon problem, which says that we have a clue. We already knew, just because of the finite proper age, that there was some unknown physics here. But now we have an observation, we have a constraint on the unknown physics. There's something that we're trying to explain. We have this clue that there's a particular pattern of fluctuations, which must have been generated by whatever fills in the question marks. So if we have a proposal for the question marks, then we can ask, does your proposal predict this particular power spectrum? And are the values of these parameters consistent with the data? So the strong horizon problem means that thinking about the question marks is not a waste of time. There's some observation that we're trying to explain. Now, there are many models nowadays for what might go in the question marks, and not all of them are described by the word inflation. But I'll start by talking about the simplest possibility. So it's an amazing fact that single field slow roll inflation works. Here's single field slow roll inflation written down as an action. At early times, the only relevant fields in the universe are the metric and a scalar field phi. And the scalar field phi is slowly evolving down a nearly flat potential. This model has the property that so if the potential was nearly flat, then the equation of state of the universe down here is close to minus one. It's minus one plus some small correction. That has the nice property that it alters the expansion history of the universe in such a way that the conformal time becomes infinite. And all of the points that we can observe in the CMB today were once in causal contact. What's really amazing about this model is that it naturally explains the perturbations. It explains the observations that we were trying to get at here. Starting from a universe with no fluctuations, it's just a prediction of quantum mechanics in a expanding background with equation of state close to minus one, that you generate fluctuations in, well, actually in all fields, the degrees of freedom of the metric, and also in this field phi, which have the right power spectrum to be consistent with the observations. I want to give just some cartoon intuition for how quantum mechanics generates fluctuations. I thought that was sort of mysterious. Even though you can follow the math, it's hard to see the intuition behind the math. So imagine that you're just doing Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics, but with a time-dependent quadratic potential. So the Hamiltonian might be 1 half p squared plus 1 half omega squared x squared, where omega is some has some explicit time dependence. And suppose that we start in the quantum mechanical ground state. Then what happens if you integrate Schrodinger's equation? Well, there are two limits that are interesting to think about. One is the case where omega is varying slowly. So if omega dot is small, here the only time scale is small means small compared to omega to the minus 2. That's the, by dimensional analysis, the only possible time scale. Then it's a theorem in quantum mechanics that if the time dependence of the Hamiltonian is adiabatic, meaning slow, that a system in the ground state will stay in the ground state. So if we change things slow enough, we can change this potential. And the wave function will track the change. It'll just evolve to the ground state of a slightly wider potential. Now in the opposite limit, where the time dependence is rapid, I'm sorry, this should have been omega squared. Then it's also easy to see, this isn't really a theorem, because you can, it's very easy to see, that what happens is that the wave function itself is frozen, so to speak, in real space. So if I start with some Gaussian wave function, if I remember correctly, the ground state wave function of a Gaussian is e to the minus omega squared x squared over 4. I'm not sure about the 4. If that's the wave function, and then I suddenly change the omega, then the wave function doesn't have time to adapt, so to speak. It can't like jump. The wave function in quantum mechanics can't ever change discontinuously in time. And so I have a Gaussian wave function, but with the wrong omega, and that would correspond to an excited state. If you imagine very suddenly, I have some particle confined in a quadratic potential, and then I very suddenly change the potential to something very flat, then what happens is that this wave function is a very excited state of the flat potential. Its occupation number, n, is large. That's the limit where the wave function, the state of the particle, can be treated as classical. It happens to be a Gaussian, so it looks like after the sudden change of the wave function, if I make measurements, it will look like a classical Gaussian random variable. So what happens is, if you come along and externally change omega, you can convert the zero-point energy of a harmonic oscillator to some classical-looking Gaussian random excitation. And in inflation, this is basically what's happening for every mode of the field, for every field, for the degrees of freedom of the metric and phi and so on. They start out in their vacuum state, but because inflation is a very violent exponential expansion, there's a lot of time dependence in their Hamiltonian, and that zero-point energy gets converted to some pattern of classical Gaussian random numbers, that is to say, a Gaussian random field. And the full calculation shows that you get something which is close to scale invariant, and even with the small tilt, even with the small deviation from scale invariance, it's actually observed. So this is really one of the most beautiful and amazing things in modern physics. One of the most fun things about cosmology is getting to go through this calculation and understand how it works. So I want to start by, oh my god, I can't believe it's 45 minutes. I want to start by just reviewing general relativity. Besides this being such a beautiful and important calculation, another secret agenda in presenting it in the lecture is that it's an excuse to do some really hard GR calculations. And that's learning how to do really hard GR calculations is just a generally useful thing to know how to do. So I want to start by just reviewing general relativity a little bit. I'm going to warm up with some easier calculations. So I want to start by, I came in ahead of time and wrote these formulas on the board. They are the most important formulas in general relativity. Let's all bask in the beautifulness of these formulas. So on the left-hand side, we have some geometric objects. Let's say you have a metric and you just want to work out the form of Einstein's equation for that metric. Then this is the chain of steps that you go through. First, you compute the Christoffel symbols from the metric, which are what you need if you want to compute covariant derivatives. Here's the Riemann curvature tensor, which tells you how to commute covariant derivatives. This is a tensor, by the way, and the gammas don't transform as a tensor. Their transformation law is more complicated. The Ricci tensor is a symmetric object that's obtained by contracting the Riemann curvature tensor. Just for fun, what would I get with this particular pattern of indices? Just for fun, what would I get if I contracted them this way? The Ricci tensor is given by this contraction. What would I get if I took this slightly different contraction? Yeah, that's right. There's the property of the Riemann curvature tensor that it's anisymmetric in these two indices. What about this one? Yeah, that's right. One way of saying it is that if I write it this way, there's a property that the Riemann curvature tensor is antisymmetric in these two indices, and whenever I contract something antisymmetric with something symmetric, I get zero. The Ricci scalar is just the trace of the Riemann curvature tensor. The Einstein tensor is R mu nu minus 1/2 G mu nu R. So these are just definitions of geometric objects constructed out of the metric. And then in the right-hand column, we have the dynamics of Einstein's equation. Einstein's equation can be derived from the action of general relativity, which is to couple this Einstein-Hilbert action, which is just the integral of the scalar curvature. Plus some matter action that tells you how the metric couples to other fields in the universe. Now you guys, this isn't done in every GR class. Did you guys do the action? Okay, great. If I vary this action with respect to the metric, then I will get some tensor T mu nu. This is the definition. I'll get some result when I vary the matter action with respect to the metric, which is defined to be T mu nu. And when I vary the Einstein-Hilbert action, I get something like M Planck squared times the Einstein tensor. And so varying this action gives Einstein's equation in this form. When I talk about inflation, I like to write M Planck instead of G, and I like the definition of M Planck, which has the 8 pi in it. Okay. Now I'm going to do like a rapid review of general relativity, which I'll structure as a bunch of quiz questions. So question one, true or false? The covariant derivative of a scalar function f is equal to its partial derivative. True. How about this one? That's right. There would be another term here involving the Christoffel symbol. So the first derivative is okay, but But then when I take the covariant derivative of a tensor, I get the partial derivative plus a Christoffel term, which it has the minus sign since this is a lower index, and it looked like this. Let me write it in two steps. It's the covariant derivative of partial nu f. Then this is partial nu, partial nu minus. And if I had more indices in the thing being differentiated, I would have more Christoffel terms with the plus sign if for upper indices or a minus sign with lower indices. Question three. I got a little confused about the definition of this object. Is it defined to be this? Or and the raised index, I have the raised index here. Do I raise the index outside the covariant derivative or inside? One vote for inside. Any other answers? Yes. Yeah, that's right. This is sort of a trick question. They're the same because they're both right. Because the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. So the notation in GR is actually kind of designed to be as efficient as possible and blur the distinction between these two. There are no ambiguities. In situations where there are multiple metrics or where you're varying the metric with respect to a parameter, then the notation in GR can contain this type of ambiguity and become confusing. Okay, so this property is sometimes called metric compatibility of the covariant derivative. Okay. True or false? One vote for false. Any other answers?
But acting on a function, isn't
it true? Yeah, this one is true. And I'll show you an example in a minute where it's false. And so this is sometimes called the statement that the covariant derivative is torsion-free. It is a theorem, by the way, that the Christoffel symbols defined over here. Define the unique covariant derivative which is torsion-free and metric compatible. Sometimes it's useful to define covariant derivatives or connections, sometimes used, a term that's sometimes used for covariant derivative, in which one of these properties is relaxed. Okay, so, and of course it is true that covariant derivatives don't always commute, but that's only the case when they act on tensors with indices. For example, if I wanted to commute in this situation, then I get a curvature term. I get one curvature term with each index, and the way those curvature terms look is something like this. There's a plus sign if the index is a lower index and a minus sign if it's an upper index. There's always each curvature term involves a contraction between the Riemann curvature tensor and the thing being differentiated. But for a scalar function, there are no indices to contract with, and there are no possible curvature terms. Here's a formula that I don't think was covered in my original GR class back in the day, but It comes up a lot in calculations, so I think it's important enough to give it a name. And so I named it the divergence formula, which is this. It says that the covariant divergence of a vector field is given by this expression. And showing this is an exercise in the homework, or in the problem set. The covariant divergence can be evaluated by this expression that just involves an ordinary partial derivative. And the reason this is kind of useful is that it shortcuts calculations because you can just write expressions that don't involve all of the Christoffel symbols. And I'll show you a nice application of that in a minute. So I want to talk about how integration by parts works in general relativity. In general relativity, you see a lot of integrals that start with integral of d4x times square root of minus g. And that's just because that combination is coordinate invariant. If I change coordinates to some coordinates gx prime, I get a factor of the Jacobian here, but a factor of the inverse Jacobian here, and they cancel. So this type of integral where I have integral of d4x times square root minus g times a covariant scalar is independent of the coordinate system in which the integral is performed. So here's a little quiz question. Which of the following integrals is zero? The x mu in these Let's say that the object x mu transforms as a tensor under coordinate transformations, although I'm not sure if that property is actually important for the question. Who wants to guess which of these four integrals is always zero? The first one is zero, and it actually has nothing to do with, this one's true. It actually has nothing to do with general relativity. If I just have the integral of an ordinary d4x times the partial derivative of something, a total derivative, the integral is zero. I guess there's an assumption here that there are no boundary terms, say because the x goes to zero at infinity. And this one is also true. If I integrate a covariant derivative with a square root minus g, so everything's covariant, then this is also zero, which I think is a thing that you might just guess when you were doing calculations. You might just assume it was true anyway. And these are not always true. And if you see them appearing in a calculation, that might be a sign that there's a better way to do the calculation. This one is non-obvious, but to prove it, let me note that by the divergence formula, if I replace this by the right-hand side of the divergence formula, then I get the integral of d4x times partial mu square root minus gx mu. And that's equal to zero because it's an integral of this type. So that's a nice, you can also prove it by writing out the definition of the covariant derivative in terms of Christoffel symbols and doing some integrations by parts, but the proof would be longer. Let's talk about covariant integration by parts. So here's a simple example. If I have an integral like this, then you might wonder whether I can integrate by parts and put minus covariant derivative of u on the f. And that's true, and just to write out a proof, In this step, I just use the product rule for covariant derivatives. And then this term goes to zero because it's a covariant derivative with a square root minus g in it. So, but it's really this, and this is the way that you might guess integration by parts works in general relativity, that the covariant derivative goes through the minus square root g when you integrate by parts, so to speak. This is the rule that actually makes that work. But there are sometimes some subtleties that arise. For example, let's think about this one. Let me write down a case where there's no subtlety first. One more case. If I have an integral like this, then if you think about pulling this covariant derivative with respect to mu outside and bringing it over by this same type of thing, you get this, no problem. Okay, here's a case where something non-trivial happens. Suppose I have this integral with the covariant derivative of a vector, and then that's contracted with the covariant derivative of another vector with the argument switched. I could simplify this by bringing this covariant derivative over here and this covariant derivative over here, and I'd pick up two minus signs with the integration by parts, so there's no sign change. And I could write it like this. And that's simplifying things a little bit because now these are just two scalars being multiplied together. I could use the divergence formula to write them in a nicer way. But there's something wrong with this step. Does anyone want to tell me what's wrong with it? It looks right. There was a flaw in this reasoning. What's that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you think through the steps, I accidentally commuted to covariant derivatives without putting in a curvature term. The general rule is you can always do an integration by parts straightforwardly if the derivative being moved over is on the outside. So, this would be correct to put in the minus sign and move this over here. But then, in the second integration by parts where I bring this out, I have to move it to the outside and then I commute and get a curvature tensor. So you get something like, let's see, let me put the, let me write out the curvature term. So this would look like I can swap the order, but then I get a curvature term, and that curvature term will have a minus sign, I guess. No. This is the curvature term that I get. Then to do one more line, now that this term, the covariant derivative is on the outside, so I can move it over. This is what I wanted. But I see that the curvature term, which appears With this contraction, it's minus the Ricci tensor, so that cancels this minus sign. And I get R mu nu X nu, R nu lambda, X nu Y lambda. It is usually the Ricci tensor and not the full Riemann tensor that appears in integration by parts and also in Einstein's equation. So in formulas, you tend to see the Ricci tensor a lot, but the full four-index Riemann curvature tensor less frequently. Oh, wow. Okay. So I'm about half finished with the GR review. I'll pick up tomorrow and talk about inflation. Thanks.